Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
For University of Illinois Extension, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, a special program as I'm traveling to the Ore Center today for the 40th anniversary celebration of that research farm, thanks to the folks over in Western Illinois for all they do for the University of Illinois College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences and U of I Extension. Coming up in this half hour, a couple of really good items for you. First, if you've been thinking about the farm bill and some of the prep that needs to be done, and that's already happening in Washington, D.C., you can bring yourself up to speed really quickly in one fell swoop. I'll talk with Carl Zuloff. He's a retired agricultural economist from The Ohio State University, about an article he and a couple of others have penned, actually several others have penned, and then presented at the Agricultural Economics Association Forum in Chicago yesterday. There are 11 different articles there. They're just one-pagers, very quickly, that you can look at on the Farm Doc Daily website. We'll review some of that with him during this half hour today. And don't forget that next week, USDA will release the first crop production report for corn and soybeans of the year. That's on the 10th of the month. We'll have Mark Schleusner here to explain how they collect the data that goes into that report. In the meantime, you might want to visit our calendar because things begin to get pretty busy. Again, I'm at the Ore Center in Perry, Illinois today for their 40th anniversary celebration. But in a couple of weeks, you can join me in Watseka if you'd like at the First Trust Savings and Loan. Look at the calendar of events on the WillAg website for complete details. The University of Illinois Agronomy Day is the following day, so that's on the 16th, Wednesday evening, and then on Thursday, starting at 7 a.m. in the morning, is Agronomy Day. More details, a lot of those, over the next 2 weeks from me, and we'd love to have you here on campus. 4-H is having a solar eclipse viewing party. That's on the 21st of August, so you can go down south and hang around in a baseball stadium to watch that solar eclipse. I wanted to be there, but frankly, I'll have to do my civic duty. I'll be on jury duty, so I may be in or out the week of the 21st. And then Farm Progress Show is at the end of the month on the 29th, the 30th, and the 31st. Of course, you're invited to Decatur and the U of I tent for the Farm Progress Show. All those things are in our calendar right there at willag.org. Join us if you can.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for more than 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really. Thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklovic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalem. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report. You know, next week, the United States Department of Agriculture will release its first crop production report of the season, at least for corn and soybeans. They'll be in lockup in Washington, D.C. Those numbers are being gathered now by a few folks that are in the field and some folks that are sending out surveys to farmers and others. We're joined by Mark Schleusner. He's with USDA's office in Springfield. Mark, thanks for being with us. Can you tell me a little bit about the crop production report and the data NAS uses in the lockup as it begins the forecasting process?
I'd be glad to, Todd, and thanks for having me on. I appreciate that. When we're in the lockup, there's two primary sources of data plus some additional ones. One primary source is the yield data reported by farmers. We send out questionnaires to a sample of producers in the major producing states, and we ask them, what do you think your corn yield is going to be? What do you think your soybean yield is going to be? And that's one of our primary indicators. We also have field staff that will ask producers for permission to go into their fields. Now, they'll do some counts and measurements. They're going to count corn stalks and corn ears. They'll measure the length of the ears. In soybean fields, they count plants and pods and blooms. And we use those two data sets as our primary indicators. We compare back over the last 5 and 10 years to see how those data are comparing to final yields. We also have other sources of data like satellite imagery, planting date, some other things like that. But those two, the farmer-reported survey data and the field counts and measurements, are our primary indications.
And then how do you put it all together and make it work?
It starts really with the producers and our field staff. Our field staff work for NASDA. We hire them and train them, but they will be talking with producers. They're doing it now, trying to get the best local data. And when that data is gathered, there's some checking going on because we've trained our field staff. They will gather the data and send it to our regional field offices. And then the statisticians in the regional field office, for instance, in St. Louis, that office covers Illinois and Missouri, those statisticians will be reviewing and analyzing the data, looking for outliers, looking for data entry errors, and examining the data closely. Once we've gotten all our data in and we've cleaned it up, we will tabulate or summarize. And then, again, those same statisticians will send a recommendation to Washington, D.C., to our headquarters. They will also put in justification comments. In other words, I think the corn yield is going to be X, and here are my reasons why. That communication is encrypted. It is highly sensitive or secret. It can move the markets, and so we take great pains with that security. The last step, then, is during the lockup process, where all the communications are shut down for a small area in the South Building in D.C., a final review and analysis by headquarters staff. I'm going in there this month for the August crop report, so I'm going to give a local perspective on Illinois. There will be discussion and analysis of all the data we're looking at from all the states, and the group will reach a consensus for the U.S. yield, and then we'll determine what the states are to add up to that U.S. yield.
And who are the members of the group?
Some of the people are the commodity experts. For instance, the corn subject matter expert. He's a good man. I've met him and been in contact with him a number of times. He is familiar with corn production practices all around the country. He is responsible for the corn production estimates, acreage, yield, production, also corn in storage and corn prices. So he is a corn subject matter expert. That's pretty much all he works on. He doesn't also do livestock surveys. He's the corn guy. And there's a soybean guy, or soybean girl. Pardon me for being too male-oriented. There's a survey methodologist. That's the job I used to have when I was in Washington, D.C. And that's more of an expert in math and statistics rather than production practices and such. That person will give a briefing on the data and talk about the strengths and weaknesses of the data they're seeing. There are other staff that work on those crop reports, plus the local people coming in from the field like me.
And what do you bring to the party, as the case may be?
I think two things. One is the local knowledge that when you are responsible for the U.S. corn yield, it's hard to be intimately familiar with 50 states, or actually more like 10 or 12 large producing states. So I can bring information on what's happened in Illinois. Illinois had a very difficult planting season around the state. That's easy to say, a difficult planting season. That's hard to quantify. And that kind of becomes the job during that lockup, is to look at the data we're seeing. So the field counts and measurements data are going to give us an ear count. And at least some producers, they were aiming for maybe 30,000 ears per acre. But because of issues, poor emergence, flooding, whatever, maybe they got 25,000 or 28,000 or some different number. That's where we can begin to quantify the impacts of a difficult planting season.
Hey, thanks so much, and good luck in Washington, D.C., and collecting the data. I take it surveys are out to farmers now?
Yes, we began collecting data about the 25th of July. I think we've got two more days to get the data in. I would encourage all producers to respond. The data you send and ask are always confidential by law and protected from the Freedom of Information Act.
Thanks so much, Mark. Mark Schleusner, of course, is with USDA NASS. He's in the Springfield office working for Illinois. And you're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. The Crop Production Report, first one of the year for corn and soybeans, comes out on August the 10th.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. On the Farm Doc Daily website now, you'll find an article posted on the 28th day of July that looks at the Farm Bill and the discussions that can and will take place this year and maybe into next year as well, as it's related to the update of that legislation in Washington, D.C. There are 11 one-page posts, all in one article, about different topic areas. These were the brainchild of Carl Zuloff and a couple of others. Carl is an agricultural economist from the Ohio State University in Columbus and now joins us. Carl, thank you so much for being here today. First, tell me why you decided and the others to put this together.
Well, my co-authors are, or co-organizers are Gary Schnitke and David Orden, and we thought that this would be a useful way of presenting material on what we think is the most important social contract between the American society in total and the rural America, and that is the Farm Bill. And so we thought this would be a good way of doing it. It would be relatively short. It would cover the scope of the Farm Bill and would provide an up-to-date, at least as of today, an assessment by various experts on what is going on with the Farm Bill.
And by various, there are academic experts involved in this process and others that do not belong to academic institutions.
That is correct, Todd. I've always thought of policy as basically a discussion. You could say debate if you want to, over ideas. And an important part of ideas is perspective on the ideas themselves. And perspectives obviously vary both by individual and by institution of the individual. And so when we were putting together the array of authors for these articles, we wanted to get a diverse array of individuals, first of all, but also a diverse array of institutions so that they would bring a diverse array of perspectives on the various issues that are confronting the Farm Bill debate or likely to confront the Farm Bill debate.
How important are the food and feeding programs, do you think, to generating votes to pass a Farm Bill?
The conventional wisdom that is widely held, Todd, is that the Farm Bill would probably not exist without the nutrition title. The nutrition title, which is also Title IV, so if you hear people use the word Title IV, what they're talking about is nutrition, is somewhere between 70 and 80% of the spending on the Farm Bill. But more importantly to the Farm Bill, it is the element of the Farm Bill that speaks to urban, suburban legislators, and particularly when you get to the House of Representatives, there are relatively few, certainly less than 100 representatives for which the farm sector and more broadly the rural sector is an important part of their constituency. And so for both political and economic reasons, the nutrition component is thought to be critical to the passage of the Farm Bill, and that probably the Farm Bill would not exist. I take, speaking personally, I take a somewhat different view. I think that there could be the possibility, and I want to underline the word could be a possibility, for a Farm Bill, but it would be fundamentally different than the Farm Bill exists today. And in particular, it would have to take the perspective of conservation and the environment as opposed to the food. So I do think there's a possibility we could maintain the Farm Bill, Todd, but it would have a very different flavor to it, a very different set of compromises, a very different set of perspectives.
Given that, it appears conservation will play a bigger role this year than it has in the recent past.
The conservation provisions actually date back to the 1930s and the Dust Bowl. They were principally concerned with soil erosion, but they've been in and out of the Farm Bills until about 1985. And then in the 85 Farm Bill, we had really one of the more fundamental Farm Bills of all time, where we brought conservation programs in, particularly the Conservation Reserve Program and other land withdrawal programs. And the provisions have remained and become increasingly important. Right now, we are projected to spend more on conservation provisions than we do on the commodity programs provision, which is the original reason the Farm Bill came to exist. In this particular debate on the conservation provision, which is Title II, so again, if you hear people say Title II, they're referring to the conservation provisions. One of the big issues that has surfaced so far is whether or not we will expand CRP. We have about a 24 million acre cap on CRP acres right now. The combination of low farm prices and low farm income and the desire to address some environmental problems has led to a lot of discussion about should that cap be higher. And that will be a debating point in this Farm Bill. And I think that would be one of the really big issues. That is not a cheap initiative. You take the rental rate that we're paying for CRP acres, you're probably talking something slightly less than $1 billion a year of expanding CRP by an amount of 10 million acres, Todd. So this is not a cheap provision, and the question becomes, where do you get the money, particularly when the budget will probably be tight for this Farm Bill?
On that note, because it is a tight budget year, do you suppose that will have much of an impact on all of the Farm Bill programming?
Well, it's very appropriate to say, Todd, that the budget has affected every Farm Bill. Now, it affects Farm Bills sometimes more than others. There is no doubt that going into this Farm Bill, there has been widespread agreement among all the policy actors that the budget will be tight. So this is not unexpected. And I think that this has continued to be the belief going into this. I would point out on the other side that there are some positive budget developments. I'm not arguing that there won't be a budget constraint and it won't affect the legislation, but we are spending less on the commodity titles than we had projected or CBO had projected at the time that the 2014 Farm Bill passed. We are spending less on crop insurance, principally because prices are lower than expected, and that's a critical determinant of how much we spend. Probably more importantly, we're spending less on nutrition programs because of the improving economy. So the baseline, they can actually point to savings from the baseline, and that's a very powerful argument within Congress. The other thing is that we have had negotiations, and I think a potential solution will be offered for the ongoing issues of dairy and cotton. Those policies have been important discussion points post the 2014 Farm Bill, and there is a proposal to attempt to deal with these policies through what is called the appropriations process. And if that happens, it could potentially add baseline to the Farm Bill. So I do expect the budget to constrain what we can do in the Farm Bill, but I think there are some reasons for believing it may not be quite as constraining as we were thinking even 6 months ago.
This article, posted to the FarmDoc Daily website, is titled Assessing the Pulse of the Next Farm Bill, so those who want to look it up can find it fairly quickly and easily. The three of you frame it up front, the 11 articles written by several folks. You frame it in three primary ways as it relates to the debate that will be happening this year. What are those?
We see three perspectives that you need to bring to any farm bill. The first is that the farm bill is a continuing piece of legislation, and so the history of the farm bill does matter, and it matters a lot. And it's not just what the legislation has been, it's what the legislation is evolving towards. The farm bills began in the 30s principally to provide economic assistance for what was a very impoverished farm sector due to the ongoing farm depression and then the more general economic depression. That has evolved into a multifaceted bill with provisions that extend all the way from research and extension to the conservation provisions to bioenergy and et cetera. So this really has become the preeminent federal social contract between America in general and the social system. The second is the budget, which we just finished talking about, but this always constrains the farm bill. It always sets the parameters. It brings into consideration that you have to move money between titles, and it brings up debates about how it should be spent within the titles. So the budget. And then the third is the overview of the issues that seem to be impacting this farm bill itself. And we think there are three primary factors that are framing these issues. And the first is that farm prices and income are lower when writing this farm bill than when the previous 2014 farm bill was written. We had a presidential election in 2016 that really was underscored by the notion that we have a disaffected rural society in this country, and then President Trump's focus on trade. The first point of lower farm prices and revenue, we suggest, implies that it's going to be difficult to cut spending in the farm safety net programs, in the insurance and the commodity titles. In terms of the impact of the election last year, we think we could see a real emphasis on rural development issues, on issues that pertain to the rural sector more broadly than just the farm sector, particularly given that this farm bill is likely to be written in 2018, which is an election year for Congress. And then the third point on trade, there's a lot of consternation and concern within the ag community about the president's position on trade. But what has also happened is that the ag community has refocused itself in some respects, that international trade is really important to it, particularly given that we have a mature domestic market for food and the bioenergy market looks less growth oriented than it was at the time we wrote the last three farm bills. And so there's been a refocus on trade, and we think that will work its way into this farm bill. So to summarize, we see the farm bill as being impacted by its history, by the current budget expected, and then by the issues themselves that are arising in this farm bill.
Thank you so much, Carl, for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Carl Zuloff is an agricultural economist from The Ohio State University. He, along with Carrie Schnitke from here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois and David Orden of Virginia Tech, have posted an article to the FarmDoc Daily website. You can look it up at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu.
It's National Ice Cream Sandwich Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1791, Samuel Briggs and his son, Samuel Briggs Jr., became the first father-son pair to receive a joint U.S. patent. Their invention was a nail-making machine. In 1861, the first U.S. national income tax was passed to aid the Union war effort. In 1880, the British Parliament adopted Greenwich Mean Time. GMT was originally set up to aid naval navigation, but it was not used on land until transportation improved. By the way, GMT was adopted by the U.S. on noon on November 18th of 1883, when telegraph lines transmitted time signals to all major cities. Before that, there were over 300 local times in the U.S. In 1887, Rowell Hodge received a patent for barbed wire. In 1956, the first new contract to build a section of the U.S. interstate highway system was awarded. It was for a portion of Route 66 in Missouri, which eventually became Interstate Highway 44. By the way, the Highway Aid Act of 1956 established a 90% federal funding level for national limited access highways. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner is now here. He's with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Drew, thanks so much for being with us. Tell me a little bit about the weather forecast. Things are changing for the month of August.
They certainly are, and we're already seeing a punch of cold air coming southward across the Dakotas today. A lot of showers and thunderstorms impacting some of the drought-stricken area there. There was some rain last night that occurred in the southwestern part of the Canadian prairies also. But it's kind of interesting. We have to keep all this in perspective. In the case of southern Saskatchewan, it has been very dry for 4 months, and they picked up on 5 or 6 tenths of an inch of rain in some of that area. So I don't think that the crops were there to be responding very well to that. Certainly not the early season crops, all the small grains and the oil seeds, early oil seeds like canola, probably did not respond much. But for corn and soybeans and flax and some other late season crops up there, there might have been some benefit, but they need much, much more rain. Anyway, the whole reason for the rain was the cool surge that's coming southward. High temperatures in the Dakotas today will be in the 60s and 70s, and we will actually see that kind of coolness spread across a big part of the Midwest as we go forward through the day tomorrow, and it will be with us on a fairly frequent basis through the weekend. So a very cool period here, and that will help to conserve moisture across the Midwest. So those areas that are borderline too dry in the subsoil will actually have an opportunity to conserve that, and it'll be available still for crops. And we do warm up a little bit later in the month, and we'll probably still manage to get by without a lot of real serious problems outside of a few pockets out there.
The cool weather will have farmers itching just a bit, especially in the northern regions of the Corn Belt, as they consider what their fall will look like. Are you concerned at all about the cool weather now as what it might relate to in the month of September?
I really don't think that it necessarily goes hand in hand. However, I do have to say that there is a likelihood that we're going to see a northwest flow pattern still occurring at times during September, and it will push cooler air down across the eastern parts of North America periodically. The other concern that I have is that the air is still very dry in parts of Canada's prairies and the northwestern U.S. plains. Anytime you have dry air and you get into the autumn season, the potential for those temperatures to fall harder during periods of dry weather becomes a little bit more significant. So there is a risk of early season frost and freezes from the Canadian prairies into the northwestern U.S. plains, and then probably across parts of Quebec and Ontario down into parts of the northeastern U.S., possibly in Michigan or northern Ohio. But all of that is going to be late in September, early October, too far out for us to get very specific about that at all. But for right now, this cool bout that we're dealing with is something that will go away. When we get in the second half of August, we'll see more normal temperatures. I don't think we have to worry about too much in the way of seriously threatening conditions in the heart of the Midwest in early September. Maybe we'll be worried about it, though, in the western parts of Canada's prairies and maybe a part of Montana. But that's kind of a different world over there.
Hey, Drew, thanks so much. We appreciate you taking the time with us today.
You bet. Have a great day.
Oh, you too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, reminding you to listen to us online at willag.org, WILLAG.org. Out of the office this afternoon, I'll be back tomorrow, and we'll talk with Dan Zwicker.